This series presents information based in part on theory and conjecture. The producer's purpose is to suggest some possible explanations, but not necessarily the only ones, to the mysteries we will examine.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
The early morning of July 2nd, 1937. Amelia Earhart and her navigator are bound westward over the lonely mid-Pacific. It is the final leg of a grueling round-the-world flight. Within several hours, they will disappear.
Now, on the website here, on AmeliaEarhartMovie.com, you talk about the various theories. And for the Japanese capture, which is the one we're going to focus on here, you say that there are a multitude of eyewitness accounts. So tell us about these eyewitness accounts. Regarding...
On the Japanese capture?
Yes.
Oh, my.
You say there's a multitude, and that's interesting because...
Well, that would be Saipan.
Mm-hmm. The Garapan prison.
Oh, my goodness, you've got me pinned down here for lack of names.
It's okay, you don't need to name
people. There was quite a few
people stories
that came out of Saipan. In fact, one of the... in the interview that Dick Spink did on the Marshall Islands, I believe it was the senator mentions that he has a cousin who lives on the island of Saipan, and he verified the same story, that she was taken to Saipan. There was, I'd say, about maybe a dozen or so people. I would have to pull out the books to call off names that believe they saw Amelia Earhart on Saipan.
At the prison.
At the prison, right.
So like you said, this is something that's fairly, I wouldn't say well-known, but it's on the Marshall Islands, I guess you could say accepted that's what happened to her?
It's fairly well accepted, yes. However, you still have to talk to the right people. If you don't, someone who is a newcomer or wasn't around when these events happened wouldn't know about them. But
right.
If you talk to the right people, you're going to hear quite a few stories about Amelia Earhart. Now, compare that to Gardner Island, where nobody saw anything, nobody knows anything, no one has ever seen anything, and nothing ever happened there as far as even the natives are concerned. That's another thing about Gardner Island. The natives there were very friendly. And there's a good reason to suspect they could have survived long enough for one of the natives that lived on the surrounding islands to find them and give them help. And that didn't happen. Nothing happened. No one ever found anything or helped them or saw anything on Gardner Island. It's just a complete blank.
Now, here's a sort of
Go ahead.
No, here's a sort of off-the-beaten-path question, and that is, has anyone... I guess let me put it this way. Do you think that the government knew that the Japanese captured Amelia Earhart and just tried to sweep it under the rug?
Yes, definitely.
Why? Just because they didn't want to inflame the situation before the war, because obviously, like I said, this is 1937. It's 4 years before Pearl Harbor. Maybe they didn't want to rock the boat with Japan and be like, give us Amelia Earhart back, man. Don't do that.
Yeah, well, there was there's considerable evidence that Roosevelt, in particular, knew that Earhart had fallen into the hands of the Japanese. And you have to realize that in 1937, they were at the stages of breaking the Japanese codes, and they knew what had happened. And shortly after she disappeared, he sent his good friend, Vincent Astor. That's, the Astor estate from New York. Became a spy for Franklin Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a pleasure yacht that they used to ride around on, that Roosevelt really loved, by the way. Roosevelt talked him into taking a cruise to the Marshall Islands to see if he could find anything about Amelia Earhart. So So what brought that on? Well, the only conclusion we can make is that Roosevelt knew that Amelia Earhart had been captured by the Japanese, and he was trying to find her.
Right.
And he asked her to take this cruise. And on this cruise, he wrote a letter back to Roosevelt. It's in the book. It's in The Lost Light, in the last chapter, where he describes what everything that was going on in the Marshall Islands. And the Japanese wouldn't even let the boat land. They chased him off, and he had to get up and turn around and go back. He had to leave. But Roosevelt tried to send one of his best friends into the Marshall Islands looking for Amelia Earhart. And so you're asking me, did the government know that Amelia Earhart was down and was captured by the Japanese? The answer is yes, she did. He did know.
Huh. Now, why?
They did know. Got the pronoun right.
There you go.
Okay, go ahead.
I guess why do you think then, if it was known by the U.S. government, and clearly it was known by the Japanese government, I guess why, you know, following the war, hasn't it come out in the ensuing years since the war ended? It would seem like the kind of thing that, you know, would be revealed, you know, in the 50s or the 60s or something like that. But here we are in 2013, and neither country's ever fessed up to what actually happened.
Well, I think the biggest reason is that the Navy and the Coast Guard could be blamed for what happened. It was really a snafu at Howland Island with those radios. I think you have enough information that you vaguely understand the problem.
Yeah.
And they were afraid that the government could be blamed for the Earhart loss. In other words, why was the radio situation such a mess, and why didn't they make contact, and why didn't they give her the bearings into the Itasca, and all these things. Really, the Coast Guard had their heads in the news, and the Navy had their heads in the news, and when it came time to land on the island of Saipan, it is believed that the Marine Corps found the grave of Amelia Earhart and had it exhumed and the body sent back to Washington.
What? That's crazy.
No.
In secret.
In secret. If you've got a copy of Lost Fight, I'll give you the page number. You want the page number?
No, I don't have it with me.
It has to do with the 441st Army Counterintelligence Corps has the information, and it's locked up, and it's been put away, and nobody has access to it. Why don't they have access to it? Because it amounts to getting access to the CIA, and that's nobody's business. So that's another problem why it's been hushed up, because they, in order to divulge that, they would have to divulge their sources and their secrets, and you're not going to talk to the CIA or counterintelligence into doing something like that. So there's reasons why it's been partially hushed up, and it has been hushed up.
See, that's amazing to me, because like I said, it's here it is 75 years later. I don't think anyone would really necessarily hold the Navy or the Coast Guard accountable at this point. I think it's such an old story that the people who would be accountable are long since gone. So it's not like there's going to be like lawsuits or anything like that. So I'm surprised that the government still doesn't want to admit to that, except maybe that it would be this sort of public relations diplomatic problem with Japan. You know, people would somehow all of a sudden resent Japan for what they did to Amelia Earhart 75 years ago. But it seems like it, you know, the time is now for people for the government just to release this information if they haven't.
Oh, well, absolutely. Freedom of Information Act. But if they're worried about Amelia Earhart, what about all of the American prisoners of war and what the Japanese did to them on the islands of Japan?
Right.
my God, it's the atrocities. Atrocities were simply something terrible.
So she, in a sense,
it's
is almost
worse than that.
Yeah. So she almost is, in a sense, a victim of the necessity to keep this, to keep all of the atrocities quiet.
Yeah, right. I'd say so.
Now, what about, now you said you became friends with Muriel Earhart. What were her thoughts on what happened to Amelia Earhart? And was she ever given any, because one would think if they sent the bodies back, there would be some contact with the Earhart family to let them, you know, privately take them into the loop, if you will, so they could at least get their family members' bodies back or have some, you know, closure on what happened. I mean, what was her whole perspective on all this?
Well, Muriel knew nothing about airplanes. She's a sweet, lovely person, and the only thing she knew was what Commander Warner Thompson from the Itasca told her. And he told her that she crashed and sank, and that was the end of it. And that's the only thing she knew. I tried to quiz her about that extensively when I was there. I was in Boston talking to her, and we became fast friends. In fact, we wrote letters back and forth. Some of the letters are in the back of the book, Lost Flight. You'll see some letters there from Muriel. And she absolutely had no idea what happened, and she just thought she crashed in the sea, and that was the end of it. But there was a lot more to it than that, a lot more.
Right, and she never...
No, she never could tell anything any different because that's all she knew. And Warner Thompson and the Coast Guard and the Navy, both of them were overly anxious to dispose of the matter, and the best way to do it was crashed and sank. So, but I think the public is entitled to know. It makes a great mystery. That's for sure.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, that's, like I said, I've been waiting 7 years here to talk about this story. It's absolutely fascinating. So you're saying that, I guess let's talk a little bit about these briefcase stories, because, you know, to really unlock this mystery, we need the physical evidence. And there's stories of I believe it was U.S. soldiers when they arrived in the Marshall Islands finding Amelia Earhart's briefcase, which then subsequently disappeared. Is that correct?
That was Saipan.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah, Saipan. Okay, you're talking about Robert Wallach, and he was an old-time Marine from World War II, and he would tell you in no uncertain terms what he found. I talked to him on the telephone. It's been about 2 hours on the telephone with him, and boy, did he blast my ears off. And he says, "I'll tell you what I found, lady. I found her briefcase." And then he says, "A passport was in there and all her important papers and maps and everything else. And don't tell me I didn't find it." That's the way he talked. And what he did was he gave the briefcase to, a Navy captain or a commander in the Navy. And that was the last he saw of it. And he gave him a receipt for the briefcase, but he lost the receipt. And unfortunately, like most things where Amelia Earhart's involved, the artifacts seem to disappear with one, and that's the inspection plate. We got that. And the door parts. The briefcase was quite real to Robert Wallach. He was a machine gunner in the Marine Corps in the invasion of Saipan, and boy, did he lay out his case. If you didn't believe him, you had to be careful or you'd get socked in the jaw. I mean, he was really mad about it.
And what was in the briefcase?
Well, her passport, Fred Noonan's passport, all her important papers.
Oh, wow.
Maps, permits. Imagine there was money in the briefcase. If they had to take along a certain amount of money to buy gasoline with or pay for maintenance or whatever they needed. And probably some of the aeronautical maps might have been in there. The one thing they did have was the canceled postage stamps, postage envelopes envelopes with the Indasha from all the places where they landed were stored in the airplane. Those have never been found, but the briefcase has been. And however, Robert Wallach's son made the statement, and he thought that the naval officer that he gave the briefcase to, the ship might have been sunk. That's why the briefcase hadn't in the wars out there off the coast of Saipan, which was...
Oh, God.
Yeah,
what a weird... That would be an even stranger fateful twist that the evidence then also sinks.
And the question is, how did they get the briefcase back? They couldn't exactly send it U.S. mail. So the ship that it was on might have been sunk in another one of the invasions, because I'm sure they didn't turn around and go back to Washington, D.C. just to transport the briefcase. So it could have been sunk on the ship at sea.
Strange. So,
yeah.
Now, you also say here on the website that there's a second briefcase of sorts, that these three Marines... entered a Japanese barracks and found a room outfitted for a woman and had a whole bunch of evidence and stuff in there. So I guess talk about that additional bit of eyewitness testimony. And that was from February of 44.
Okay, that was the island of Roy Namur in the Marshall Islands.
Mm-hmm.
And the second briefcase was the briefcase they found that was empty. In the barracks there, or no, I think this was on they found it on the beaches or someplace, and had the initials AE on it, and that's all there was to that one. And the thing was empty, and that would be the second briefcase. The primary briefcase, I believe, was taken to Saipan, and that was the one that was locked up at the safe that Robert Wallach found. The second briefcase was the one from the island of Roy Namur, which I believe was found lying on the beach or someplace and discarded with the initials AE on it. And it really didn't amount to too much, but that's the only description we have of it.
Yeah, well, here on the website it says the three Marines entered a Japanese barracks and found a room outfitted for a woman. A W.B. Jackson said they found a suitcase containing feminine items and a bound, locked book, letters, 10-year diary of Amelia Earhart. What do you know about that whole aspect of it?
We've been looking for that for a long time, and it's never been found. Whatever happened to those items, we simply don't know.
Yeah.
Disappeared the same as the briefcase and all... and all the rest of the artifacts, with the exception of the inspection plate and the door parts. We've got that. We hope. Say a prayer that we're right, and if we are right, and it gets the publicity it deserves, why, I think it's going to change a lot of people's minds.
Absolutely.
Well,
now, what about the part of the story here? It's sort of in addition to the Japanese capture, and that is that Amelia Earhart came back from Japan before or after World War II in disguise. Talk about that whole part of the theory, because then it gets even wilder.
Okay, there's a big theory that was advanced by Joe Kloss and Joe Gervais, who teamed up. Joe Kloss wrote the book, and they decided that there was a woman by the name of Irene Bolam who came back to this country in disguise when she was in fact Amelia Earhart. But Amelia Earhart was taken from the island of Saipan to Weishan concentration camp in China. And from Weishan concentration camp, she was taken to Tokyo. And after the war and the city was liberated, she sneaked back into the United States with the help of a Catholic priest. Father or Monsignor, I have to look up his name. And she's been hiding out ever since. However, the problem is that her family never accepted this woman, Irene Bolam, as their sister.
Yeah.
As George Putnam's wife, she was never accepted as that. And that right there was enough to sour anyone. We have a considerable treatise in Lost Flight on disproving Irene Bolam, and the whole thing turned out to be a series of amazing incidents, but a little bit like Gardner Island, completely unprovable. And if you get a copy of Lost Flight, you can read the actually an essay of four of the people I work with who wrote on the Irene Bolam situation.
Right, right. And it sounds like you're saying that did the Earhart family ever even encounter this Irene Bolam?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, definitely. They knew each other. Muriel knew her, and it was just a casual hello, and that was it.
Hmm.
And she never said anything to her. And if Muriel didn't know her own sister, I'd say there was something wrong someplace.
That's really strange. And it doesn't really make any sense. Why would Amelia Earhart come back to the United States under an assumed name anyway?
That's true.
You know,
see, it's another situation like Gardner Island. It doesn't make any sense. It just simply doesn't make any sense. I give Gillespie and Tiger a lot of credit for doing a lot of work on the subject matter, but it just doesn't work. I can't believe what they have there, and I can't believe that, and I can't believe Irene Bolam, either one of them. They just are nonsensical events, basically.
Now, how come, you know, you're very skeptical and critical of the Gardner Island expeditions. Why hasn't Tigar turned and looked at the Marshall Islands, if you think there's, if you know, considering how strong you think the case is for that as the landing point?
Well, I really can't answer that, and to make the story short, I wish you would. But he doesn't seem to be inclined on Marshall Island theories or Saipan theories, either one. And he's going to make or break on Gardner Island, and so far it's a wasted effort. There's nothing there to go on. Nothing. Nobody saw anything. Nobody heard anything. The natives don't know anything. Nobody knew, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. Nothing there.
Yeah.
Just a bunch of junk off the beach, basically.
Now, why do you think that, I realize it's been 75 years plus now, 76 years since the disappearance, but I find it remarkable in a way that this story, now I'm a child of the 80s, I remember Unsolved Mysteries and sightings and that kind of stuff, and this was always sort of one of the staple paranormal, for lack of a better term, cases out there. Why do you think that here now in the last, like, 15, 20 years, it's really kind of fallen off the radar, no pun intended, to the paranormal folks out there? You know what I mean? It's not nearly as discussed as much as it used to be, like the Bermuda Triangle kind of, and some of these other stories that were big in the 70s and 80s that aren't now anymore.
Well, I think a lot of people are losing interest because there hasn't been any artifacts found. And the claims that have been made, and especially by Tiger and Gardner Island, none of them have ever proven anything. I think the public really is getting a little bit tired of listening to that stuff. You know, after a while it gets to be stale. Just another story from Gardner Island. And like with the Freckle Cream and all the rest of the bone stories and the DNA, none of it has ever proven false. I think the public is getting tired of it. I think this much, if that inspection plate, if we can get that inspection plate on television and get the story of stories of what I'm telling you, which is part of the Amelia Earhart mystery. It's a documentary with three episodes. The first two are what happened, and the third episode is Millie Atoll, Marshall Islands. We can get that on television. I think it's going to spark a lot of interest.
Yeah.
I hope it will. And because that's what it takes, is the publicity to make this work.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I've heard this captured by the Japanese theory out there for a while, but it hasn't really ever... It gets drowned out by the Gardner Island stuff. So
yeah,
I think people think it's too fantastic a story to believe, almost. Do you know what I mean? I think people...
Yeah.
That might, it almost suffers from the truth is stranger than fiction, if it is true. Do you know what I mean? People say, oh, I can't believe that. You know, they can't believe that she would be captured and executed.
Yeah, true. Well, no, that's more believable than Gardner Island. She vanished on a deserted island that's just captured and executed by the Japanese is more like it. People are slowly coming around, but they don't have the whole story, and what we're attempting to do is to give them the whole story. I think you're getting part of it. I think you understand some of it. And you need to read the book, number one, and I'm praying that a few more months goes by and we'll be able to get this on television.
It's interesting. You seem very confident that this is a solvable case. I guess what really puzzles me in a way is, you know, here we are 75 plus years later. You worry, you know, the thing about racing the Undertaker. I mean, most of the people involved in all this are long since gone, and you know, you wonder if it's a mystery that's going to be lost to the sands of time. But you feel like that with this new evidence and everything that we may be closer than ever to actually getting to the bottom of this.
Right. Well, the releasing of the files in Fredericksburg, or I found out the truth about this Joseph Gurr, all of a sudden the story began to fit together really good. I think we found out what really happened at Howland Island. She's sitting there trying to direction fine with on high frequency. Impossible. The radios were never designed to do that. And that was the real reason why she failed at Howland Island. And I put the blame on Joseph Gurr. That will be in the documentaries for television. And then we find the inspection plate at Millie Atoll, and that I think that's the icing on the cake.
Yeah.
I think we're pinning it down to the point where we think we've got this located and pinned down, a mystery solved, so to speak.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting. You know, it's like I was saying at the beginning of the conversation when we started talking about the story in general. It didn't really sort of cross my mind or dawn on me till we got further into this. But I mean, if we're, you know, we got listeners right now that are like in their 20s and stuff, that they're probably like 3 or 4 generations removed now from the mystery. So it really is slipping further and further back into the sands of time.
Well, that's true. Well, we intend to resurrect the dead. How about that?
There you go.
We've got a Joan of Arc movie coming up here, see? So we get the movie on the screen. That would really spark a lot of interest.
Absolutely.
The movie and the television documentaries with 3 episodes.
You know, I'm always hearing about these trips to Gardner Island to find stuff and that sort of thing. How come, I guess you're saying that Dick Spink did do that, but I was asking, you know, I'm surprised there aren't more expeditions to Saipan or...
Well, there have been expeditions to Saipan, only they never made the headlines. And there has been expeditions to the Marshall Islands, only they've never been made, but they have never made the headlines because there wasn't anything found.
Yeah.
And that's the trump card that Gillespie and Tiger has. They claim they find these things. But the findings are completely erroneous. They simply don't add up. There's no way that they can be traced to Amelia Earhart. None of them. But then that doesn't stop him. He still keeps putting out press releases. Oh, I found so-and-so. And he just keeps going with it, and that keeps it alive.
Yeah. Well, it's disappointing because, you know, for those of us who are real old-school paranormal enthusiasts, this is one mystery that we want to see solved that that, you know, okay, it should be solvable. Yeah. It's amazing that it hasn't been solved by now. I'm still amazed. I got to go back to this, and, you know, I still am amazed that if the U.S. government and the Japanese government know about this, that they still won't just reveal what happened. I find that kind of maddening in a sense. You know, but I guess really part of it, to answer sort of my own devil's advocate perspective, is that at this point, who in the Army or the U.S. government would even know? Like I said, we're three or four generations removed from this story, so I guess it could stand to reason that, you know, you could probably get the head of the Navy in there right now, and he probably wouldn't have any idea where the information about Amelia Earhart could be found.
Yeah, true. True. Well, no, see, that's getting to the point where it's almost water over the dam. But bringing back a historical story like this, I think we'll eventually, assuming we've got the right evidence, and the story about Joseph Gurr, I've got the evidence on that. I've got the interview that was made, and it was tape recorded, by the way.
Yeah.
We've got that, so I'm not worried about that part, but I think you're going to hear a lot about this in the future, a lot. And I hope that the people who are behind it, well, I hope it helps the sale of the book, The Lost Flight of Amelia Earhart, and I believe that they might get successive runs on television so everyone can see the documentaries. Because they're very good. They cover the two areas. They cover what really happened and with the radio situation.
Right.
And then the third episode, the Millie Atoll situation, where we found that inspection flight.
Now you're saying episode, is it a TV program that's out right now that we know about, or is it like an independent project?
No, it's in the process of being produced. Allied Artists has it. Felix Gerard at Allied Artists. He's the one that you're looking at the website. He's the one that designed that website.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one who's working on this to bring it to the screen. And we think that we will probably be able to sell the documentaries to the Discovery Channel or National Geographic or History Channel or somewhere in that line.
We've talked about how this plate that you've recovered is the, you know, is sort of the, you know, the linchpin to this whole breakthrough, if you will. Where is it right now, and what needs to be done with it, and you know, what's the next step to be taken with this evidence?
Well, Dick Spink sent me the plate. I've got the plate right here in my office, and he sent me part of the door parts, and he sent me a knob off the upholstery. I've got them here, only I don't want to be the safekeeper. I'm going to send it back to Dick Spink because he needs to go out and start making lectures and actually show them the plate after the lecture is over with. So I think he's the one who should have the plate.
Yeah.
I don't really want to be responsible for it. If something happens to it, then they could blame me, but doesn't make any difference. We've got enough pictures of it that we can reproduce everything but the plate.
Yeah, you're not concerned for your safety or anything like that. You're not. You don't think someone's going to come and like steal it or anything, right?
No, that's even if they did, we still have plenty of pictures.
Right, right. You just don't want it around, really.
Yeah. I would appreciate, I'm sending it back to Dick Spink. I'm not going to keep it here much longer, maybe a few more days. And so I'll let Dick Spink lock it up in his safe. It needs to be in a safety deposit box someplace. That's where it needs to be.
Okay. Now, you definitely got to send me these pictures because people are going to want to see that for sure.
Oh, yeah.
And can there, I guess, like I said, what else? Now, we know where it is. What else needs to be done? Is there any sort of, like, testing that can be done on this thing, or is it more just sort of trying to match it up to the pictures of the plane?
Well, right now, we're just trying to match it up with pictures off the airplane. There's two 10Es, Lockheed 10Es, Electras, One is in New Jersey, and the other one is in the state of Washington, Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it would be the same plate off those airplanes. However, those are 10Es. However, the Model 12, Lockheed 12, L-12, was the same airplane, only slightly smaller, but it had the same engines. And because it had the same engines, its inspection plate might be the same inspection plate. I don't know.
Yeah. I didn't even mention this, but I feel like maybe we should, if we're going to be a comprehensive look at the whole story, just quickly talk about and dismiss the whole Tokyo Rose aspect of the Amelia Earhart story, because that's been around for years, and it seems pretty well debunked or, you know, not given any credence at this point. But like I said, if we're going to be a comprehensive conversation, I guess we have to touch on that. So talk a little bit about the Tokyo Rose rumors.
Okay, the Tokyo Rose rumors started with the rumors that Earhart was taken from Saipan prison to Weishan concentration camp. And from Weishan concentration camp, that's in China during the 1930s, from Weishan, she was taken to Tokyo. And in Tokyo, she was inveigled into announcing herself as Tokyo Rose. And there doesn't seem to be any substance to it. It's another dead end, like Irene Boehm. What proof is there that she was Tokyo Rose? It's a bunch of hooliganism, really. And if she was taken from Weishan concentration camp to Tokyo, what is the basis for that? And not only that, but there's voice recognition involved with this. For instance, Irene Boehm had a New Jersey accent. She talked with a New Jersey accent, you know, like that. And since when does a girl from Kansas have a New Jersey accent? So, if we had the actual Tokyo Rose broadcast, they could have done a voice print on that and disproved it very easily. But I'll tell you the truth, I don't think there was enough interest in this Tokyo Rose stuff that anybody ever paid any attention to it.
Right. Sounds more like an urban legend.
Oh, yeah.
That's why, you know, that's why it took me so long to even mention it to you. But I figured if we didn't, it would come up later that someone would say, why, you know, ask why we didn't get into it. So I figured might as well discuss it and dismiss it. So you don't think that there's any credence to that?
I know, none at all.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about the book. The Lost Flight of Amelia Earhart. Now, this is sort of a fictional tale which weaves in all of this research, correct?
Yeah, correct. Actually, I wrote the screenplay first, and we weren't getting anywhere with the screenplay, and I didn't have anything to do, so I decided I was going to turn it into a book, and that's what I did. And it's kind of a semi-novel type of book, a blueprint, you might say, but a format, that's the word I'm looking for. But there's a lot of historical evidence in there and a lot of reasons why as to what happened and the 281 message. And I wanted it so that it would be easy to read. It's an easy reading book. A lot of people have said that. And I think once you've been through that you'll really understand what happened with Amelia Earhart. And that flight across the Atlantic where she soloed, that was, oh my goodness, just 2 hours out of Newfoundland, she was fighting for her life, and the wings were icing up, and the plane was nosediving almost into the sea, and the gasoline line over the fuselage broke and streaming down her neck with, I think it was probably 87 octane gasoline.
Oh boy.
And the speedometer broke. She didn't know how fast she was going. And I don't see how she really made it across the sea, but she did make it across the sea. And that's in the book. You've got that. And what I tried to do, and you also got the voyage of the Norma Hall. That was Vincent Astor's yacht that he went cruising in the Marshall Islands looking for Amelia Earhart that President Roosevelt wanted him to do. And you've got the letter there that he wrote back to Roosevelt. And then in the back sections of the book, it's 371 pages, something like that. I have to look it up. And the back pages of the book are the emails and the research information that went into this. And that's very interesting. And you've got, the disproving of, the Irene Bolam stories. And you've also got another important part. You've got, the actual radio logs of the Itasca, and you can see what the transmissions were, and they're translated from radio code into English that you can understand.
Yeah.
And that's easy to read that. There's a time series.
Okay, so that's all in the book. Where can folks pick up The Lost Flight of Amelia Earhart? How can they get it?
Okay, off the website. I'm working with the website would be the place to buy it. LostFlight.net or AmeliaEarhartMovie.com.
Okay.
LostFlight.net is my website, Prairie Books, and the movie website is Allied Artists.
Excellent.
I'm negotiating with Casebrook publishers, and I believe that they will be the ones who put it in the bookstores. Right now, I haven't gotten to it yet. There's too much with the television programs and everything going on.
Yeah.
Best place to buy it right now is the websites, those two websites.
All right, LostFlight.net and or AmeliaEarhartMovie.com. Probably LostFlight.net, easier for folks who probably will have a hard time spelling spelling all that. Okay, so I guess the final question here where we wrap it up is, you know, what's next for you? You got these documentaries and stuff. Where can people find out, you know, where this new information is going to be coming from you at AmeliaEarhartMovie.com and LostFlight.net? Should they stay tuned there to find out, you know, if and when these documentaries are going to air and more about the evidence?
Yes. I have a spot on Facebook, but I haven't been keeping it up to date because I'm too busy with all these other things.
Mm-hmm.
But the best spot are the LostFlight.net. And AmeliaEarhartMovie.com, in particular Lost Flight Net, because I keep that up constantly. Something really sensational comes along. And there's things on LostFlight.net that are not really on AmeliaEarhartMovie.com, which Felix, I blame Felix for that. He's able to do certain things.
That Felix, he's always up to no good. I gotta give credit here. It's Pat Daniels from the Fringe Radio Show on KTKK AM 630. I was on his program a couple months ago, and he gave you a glowing recommendation and suggested that we have you on the show. So I want to make sure I mention that.
Yeah, I spent about 2 hours on the radio with him, and he gave me a good workout. I'll tell you that.
Well,
almost as good as yours.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Well, on that note, you know, folks, stay tuned to LostFlight.net and keep your eyes peeled for Carol Lynn Dow, because you're going to be seeing more from her, I'm sure, in the weeks and months and years to come as this story keeps revolving. I got to give you credit. You know, so few people are looking at the Amelia Earhart story still, that you're doing yeoman's work to keep this thing alive and hopefully get to the bottom of it once and for all. You know, for the folks like me who've been looking at all these different mysteries, to get one of these solved would be just fantastic. So, you know, let's hope this is at least one of many that will eventually be solved, and it'll be thanks to your work and, you know, trying to get to the bottom of what really happened to Amelia Earhart. Thank you very much. And, once again, thank you, Carol, for appearing on the program, and keep us posted on the latest news, and you know, hopefully we'll bring you back maybe once the case is solved, and we'll bring you back for a celebratory conversation where we you know, rub it in the face of all the skeptics, right?
Good for you. Good for you. Yeah, I'll buy that.
That does it for this edition of BOA Audio Season 7. Big, big thanks to Carol Lynn Dow for coming on the show. Be sure to check out her website, www.lostflight.net. Pretty simple, all one word, lostflight.net. Check it out. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA Audio Listener Feedback. And since we skipped this segment over the last couple of episodes, we definitely want to dive into the mailbag here this week. So let's do so with three long emails from the listeners. The first one comes from Neil, no hometown listed. Here's what he has to say. I enjoy your shows and am a relatively new listener. I think I found you by searching for Bart Sibrel interviews. While I know your programming focuses on the esoteric, listening to your broadcasts with guests like Gerard Williams, Kendall Carver, Andre Eglishon, etc., to me, you really shine. I've been listening to talk radio since my dad exposed me to it when I was young, 40-plus years ago, and your skills as a host are outstanding when dealing with mainstream stuff. You are interesting and fun, and have taken the time to learn the subject matter while not stepping on the guest. You're no slouch with the paranormal slash esoteric stuff, but for me, gripping contemporary subject matter with an engaging host that knows his boundaries and a solid guest makes for outstanding listening. Thanks for your work, Neil. Thank you for writing in, Neil, and thank you for your kind words, my friend. I am humbled by your email here. And you've touched on pretty much a big facet of the program over the last few seasons, and that is our move, I wouldn't say necessarily away from the paranormal, but our adoption of the peripheral topics of esoterica. I do love the, as you call it, mainstream stuff, contemporary subject matter. And I hope to do more of that stuff in the future. And stay tuned here to the end of the program because we've got a very similar type topic on the next edition of the program. And chances are, as we get rolling into Season 8, you're going to be hearing a lot more of that stuff here on the program. Because, you know, we've been doing the show for 7 years now. We're going to be kicking off our 8th year in a few months. And there's only so many times you can rehash the paranormal. There's only so many ways you can examine UFOs and Bigfoot without really just becoming tedious. And I can assure you we're always going to be covering UFOs, Bigfoot, conspiracy theories, ghosts on the program, but I'm definitely making an effort more and more as each year goes by to include more fringe topics and more stuff that really just sort of falls into the edges of the paranormal and esoteric. And based on listener feedback, that is definitely something that the folks listening to the program want to hear as well. So thank you for writing in, Neil. Much appreciated. And keep tuning in, I guess, is all I have to say beyond that. The next email is a bit of a critical one, but let's tackle this one as well. It comes from Dave in Wichita, Kansas. Here's what he has to say. Just so you know, I am not hiding from you. I am Dave in Wichita, Kansas. I know pretty much what you are going to say, because the show is yours, and you can pontificate on this matter as long as you want. There will be no two-way conversation here. You will read my brief criticism, and then you will take as long as you want to abuse and disrespect what I have to say. I fully expect to have to quit listening to your show, which is a real shame. You have such interesting shows, and your interviewing style has improved greatly the last few years, that I will miss you. I do listen behind several months, so I will listen till you respond to my email. I once listened to a wildly popular podcast, but then the hosts started eating and drinking without muting their microphone. I am old-fashioned in that I think any media should have just a tad bit of decorum. Listening to mouth sounds is not enlightening at all. I stopped listening to those folks. The same goes for your continual lighting, inhaling, and puffing on cigarettes or joints or whatever it is that you are doing. It is absolutely gross to listen to your smoking activities. I am not saying you should quit smoking, but for God's sake, learn where the mute button on the microphone is, or invent one, or refrain for an hour or so. Please, show some respect. I shall miss you, Tim. Take care, Dave, in Wichita, Kansas. Thank you for writing in, Dave. I've already actually reached out to Dave, because I was a little put off here by this tone, in a sense, where he expects that I'm going to abuse and disrespect what he has to say. I don't know where you get that from, Dave. That's not the style of the program. That's not my style as the host. I respect all of the listeners, and I respect their feedback, whether it's positive or negative. So, you know, put the gun back in the holster, Dave. We're all friends here, pal. And with regards to the smoking, first of all, I will absolutely clarify, it's not joints. I'm not smoking joints while I'm doing the interview. That would be just more chaotic and more bizarre of a program than ever. So it's just cigarettes, and I've gotten mixed reaction from people, actually, Dave. You're the first person to write in and be really critical of the raw sound of the lighting and the inhaling during the program. A lot of folks really actually kind of enjoy it. They think it gives it sort of an underground, raw feel to the program. But I see your point of view, and I respect your point of view, and the best I can tell you right now is stay tuned to Season 8, because I am under tremendous pressure from family and friends to quit smoking. And I've made some real good strides toward quitting smoking, and I'm hopeful that by the time Season 8 starts, I will be smoke-free. So we've only got a couple more episodes in Season 7, and then hopefully by the time Season 8 starts, there will be no more lighting, inhaling, or puffing on cigarettes during the program. I can't make any promises, but I'm really going to focus on that in a big way once I get into the hiatus portion between Seasons 7 and 8. And I'm sorry that you feel so passionately about giving up the program because of this distraction, because really it's a minute portion of the show. I think maybe you only hear me lighting a cigarette 3-4 times in an episode, maybe at most, but it really seems to be something that is upsetting to Dave, and I respect that, and I apologize that it is, and as I said, hopefully it will become a moot point in the future as my personal quest to kick the habit of smoking continues here in the summer, and hopefully it will be successful by the time we roll out Season 8. And hopefully by then, Dave will still be listening to the program. Dave, don't give up on us, pal. We're a work in progress. So just stick with Banal of America Audio, because we evolve as the years go on. The next email comes from Caroline in Eltham, New Zealand, and here's what she has to say. I've recently discovered your audio archives and just wanted to say a heartfelt thank you. I've recently started a home-based business and beat the boredom at my computer by listening to your podcasts. You sound grounded and aren't out to impress others, except in doing the best job you can. I haven't heard you disrespect anyone yet, despite the difficult personalities you sometimes interact with. I'm not saying that there isn't an occasional shoot-me-now moment when some expert or other turns out to be a bit of what we call in New Zealand a dryballs, origin of the term unknown. I could rattle on at length, but let me finish by telling you a strange waking dream I had the other morning. I was lying there in bed, willing myself to arise this very cold morning, when I heard your show announced in my left ear. Then I heard you talking to a British guy. He had a posh accent, not like a lot of the Brits you have spoken with. No offense to them. Here's what your topic was. The development of a new man, or a new kind of human. It is my understanding the managed, I didn't get by who, upgrading of humanity through various methods, including getting us to think differently, but a physical element was implied also. Now, I don't go around ruminating or reading about stuff like that, and haven't heard anyone talk about any such thing. I have forgotten the exact words, but that's the gist of it. So thanks for that unexpected audio, a great start to my day. Many thanks, and I swear when my business takes off, I'll be making regular donations to Banal of America. Caroline in Eltham, District of Taranaki, North Island, New Zealand. Amazing. I'm blown away by an email coming all the way from New Zealand. That's about as far away from BOA HQ as you can get. And Caroline's down there listening to the show while putting together her home-based business. So thank you for writing in, Carolyn. I'm just completely blown away by the geography of the email in and of itself. When I first glanced at the email, I thought you were asking me about that topic, but now I'm seeing that actually it was a dream you had, which is kind of spooky because I haven't actually done that topic yet on the show, but part of me is getting like a pre-deja vu feeling, like I'm going to be doing that topic at some point in the future, and I'm going to have a guest pretty much talking about what you're saying, and I'm going to freak out because it's something that was predicted by Caroline in New Zealand way back in June of 2013. So we may have the beginnings of a really weird turn of events in the future. I would love if that happened. So we'll see if it does. I'm not going to try and make it happen, but if it does happen, that would be really weird. And I don't know what it says about you, Caroline, that you're dreaming about the program, but I guess it's cool. Maybe you're listening too much. I don't know. Just kidding, of course. beyond that, thank you for your kind words about the program. Glad to hear you've discovered the audio archives, and I hope you are enjoying digging into all 200-plus episodes. Stay tuned, because you never know. Hopefully, in the future, we'll stumble across that very snippet of dialogue that you had a precognitive dream about that one cold morning. That would be absolutely mind-blowing and something that I would just completely love. So, once again, thank you for writing in, Caroline. Best of luck with your business down there in New Zealand. We got one more tiny little correspondence. It comes from Super Dan Wonder 5 on the BOA forum, theusofe.com. He bumped the episode with James Gutman from BOA Audio Season 1, and he says, "Wow, I'm like 7 years late on this one. Any chance there'll be another wrestling-type show in the future? I really enjoyed this one." I kind of plucked that one from the forum as a segue to two things. First of all, yes, there's a very good chance we'll be doing another wrestling-type show in the future. I'm kind of working on something like that for Season 8. And the guest potentially is a really, really cool guest and someone I think people will really enjoy hearing from. And hopefully by the end of 2013, BOA Audio will have ventured back into the squared circle for another discussion on pro wrestling. And the other reason why I plucked that comment out from the forum is to segue into the call for guest suggestions. I've already got a bunch here from BOA Audio listeners due to my call for guest suggestions on the last edition of the program. We're definitely putting together the list for Season 8. We're compiling the to speak with list or the to investigate list. And that's where you come in, folks, the BOA Audio listeners. Send me your guest suggestions. Tell me who you'd like to hear on the program, and I will do my best to look into their stuff and see if they'd be a good fit for the program. And if so, have them on BOA Audio for an extended conversation. How do you get in touch with me? That's simple. You can write to boaaudio@hotmail.com or just head on over to banalofamerica.com and click the contact button. And if you want something a little more interactive like Super Dan Wonder 5 did, you can join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. We like to call it BOA's paranormal playground. It is the United States of Esoterica. If you don't want to write all the letters down, just head on over to Banal of America and click the forum button. Additionally, I am on Facebook and Twitter, so just punch in Binall, B-I-N-N-A-L-L, and that will bring up my pages on those social network sites. Feel free to befriend me, follow me, or poke me. It's all good, and I'd be happy to have you as part of my online circle of friends. Additionally, and finally, we are on Facebook in Binall of America form. We are at 984 likes, so we are a mere 16 likes away from the long-anticipated 1,000 likes. How do you find us there? Easily. You just punch in Banal of America on Facebook. That'll bring up the official BOA page on Facebook. Like us, if you have not done so yet. Like number 1,000 gets a shout-out here at the end of the program, and chances are a number of folks along the way to 1,000 will also get shout-outs here at the end. So don't be afraid to be like number 990 or something like that, because there's a good chance you're going to get a shout-out here at the end of the program. Up next, please allow me to take a moment here and thank the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff, Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, our webmaster Ray Weigel, and our graphics guru Jeremy Boston. BOA 3.0 is chugging along. I just had a meeting with Ray Weigel recently about the progress on BOA 3.0. Jeremy Boston is hard at work putting the final touches on the graphics for BOA 3.0. It's all coming together very good, and it is hopefully going to be rolled out to the BOA visitors very, very soon. So for now, all I can say really is keep an eye on Banal of America, because a change is in the air. A paradigm shift of epic proportions is on the cusp at BOA. The future has nearly arrived, my friends. Now comes the time in the program where I take my hat off and pass it around to the BOA audio listeners and ask you to make a donation to the Banal of America franchise. How do you do that? That's simple. Head on over to banalofamerica.com and click the PayPal button. That'll take you to PayPal. They'll walk you through the process. It's safe, secure, and simple. But if you don't trust the internet and you want to make a snail mail donation, you can do so by writing to Tim Banal, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. And you can find the complete address at Banal of America under the PayPal button. It bears repeating, as always, folks, no donation is too small, and all donations go towards Banal of America and BOA Audio to help keep the entire franchise up and running, freely available, and commercial-free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. On the next edition of BOA Audio, we are venturing into the world of alternative history once again as we welcome back our friend Bill Burns, who is the co-author of the new book, Dr. Feelgood, which is subtitled The Shocking Story of the Doctor Who May Have Changed History by Treating and Drugging JFK, Marilyn, Elvis, and Other Prominent Figures. I can't say too much about this because I actually haven't sat down and spoken with Bill yet. We're going to be talking next week about Dr. Feelgood, but I am well versed in the book, having read quite a bit of it already, and am wrapping that up soon. And it is tremendous stuff, folks. It is compelling stuff. It is about a man by the name of Dr. Max Jacobson, who emigrated from Europe to America and designed this quote-unquote feel-good potion, if you will, that actually contained methamphetamines, and subsequently got many, many powerful people in the world of entertainment and politics hooked on his serum. It is amazing stuff. It is really compelling information and shocking in a lot of ways how far-reaching and just impactful the influence of Dr. Max Jacobson was on the mid-20th century. So we're going to be delving into that on the next edition of BOA Audio with Bill Burns. I am looking forward to a very compelling conversation. And on that note, we close the book on another installment of BOA Audio. Big, big thanks to Carol Lynn Dow for coming on the show and giving us so much time. Thanks to Neil, Dave, Caroline, and Super Dan Wonder 5 for their participation in BOA Audio Listener Feedback. And, of course, enormous thanks to all you folks out there, the hardcore BOA Audio listeners, the folks who tune in to the very end of the program and listen to my ramblings here at the end of the show. Thank you for your enduring support of the program. It is truly and humbly appreciated. And, of course, once again, Thank you for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Benall, thanking you for listening and signing off.